From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, three people connected with new TV shows. First, we'll hear from John Mahoney. He plays the father of the radio shrink Frasier Crane on the Cheers spin-off Frasier. Then we'll hear from Stephen Bochco and Dennis Franz, the producer and star of NYPD Blue. They first worked together on Hill Street Blues. Also today, we'll hear an interview with comic, actor, and writer Gary Shandling, who just concluded his second season on HBO's satire of late-night talk shows, The Larry Sanders Show. All of today's interviews are from our archives. Robert De Niro just made his directorial debut. Stephen Schiff will review De Niro's new movie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Survivors of the massive earthquake that struck southwestern India this week are spending a second night out in the open, surrounded by the rubble of their destroyed homes. Mass graves have been dug for Muslims who were killed, and Hindu victims are being cremated. David Loyne reports for the BBC.
Those killed mostly lived in heavily built stone houses in small villages. The earthquake shook down the houses, often leaving more modern buildings intact. Recovering the bodies is the first task of the big army operation now underway. But they've also found some survivors. Three children were dug from the rubble in two separate villages, unconscious but alive, more than 24 hours after the earthquakes. By Sunday, the next phase of the army operation should be well underway, clearing the rubble and providing shelter for those made homeless. The shelters are being put up on open ground to encourage survivors to remain near their former homes rather than flee as refugees.
David Loyne reporting. Delegates at a U.S.-sponsored conference have pledged $2 billion in aid to make Palestinian self-rule successful in the Israeli-occupied territories. Representatives from nearly 50 nations met today at the conference in Washington. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen said they pledged more than $600 million for the first year, with commitments of almost $2 million for the five-year period of interim self-rule. The European Community has pledged $600 million over 5 years, and the United States has promised $500 million. A trio of economic reports released today provided positive news for the economy, but overall the news wasn't as good as analysts had expected. NPR's John Idstey reports.
The most positive report came from the government's Index of Leading Economic Indicators, which is a rough predictor of economic activity 6 to 9 months in the future. Paced by more building activity and fewer claims for unemployment, the index rose 1%, its strongest showing since December. It was the third month in a row that the index moved up. New orders for manufactured goods also climbed during August. But the 0.9% jump was less than analysts had expected after last month's sharp drop. And if transportation goods were not counted, new orders wouldn't have improved at all. Finally, the Purchasing Managers Index rose slightly, but remained just under 50%. A reading below 50% suggests the manufacturing sector is declining. Altogether, today's reports did not provide the hoped-for evidence of an economy finally consolidating its strength. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 26 points to close at 3,581. Advancing issues led to declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. The standoff continues between President Boris Yeltsin and the parliament he's trying to disband. Negotiators for the Russian government said that no progress was made today, but that more talks are set for tomorrow. In the meantime, the government has cut off electricity to the building, and police are trying to harass lawmakers inside by playing loud rock and roll and rap music. A crackdown by the U.S. Border Patrol on undocumented Mexicans in El Paso, Texas, is being sharply protested by the Mexican government. NPR's David Wellner has more from Mexico City.
Mexico's foreign ministry condemns in a statement the so-called Operation Blockade that was started last week by U.S. Border Patrol agents between the neighboring cities of El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. The foreign ministry calls for an end to the operation, which has sharply reduced the number of Mexicans crossing the border to El Paso, and which could soon expand to other border crossings. Officials here call the beefed-up border patrolling intimidating and charge that it's leading to unnecessary tensions. There have been daily protests in Ciudad Juarez since the operation began, and the head of the city's Chamber of Commerce has called for Mexicans to boycott stores in El Paso. Mexican Foreign Minister Fernando Solana expressed concern over the situation on Wednesday to U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher, telling him this did nothing to improve relations between Mexico and the U.S. I'm David Balma in Mexico City.
Figures released today by the Labor Department show that highway accidents are the most common cause of deaths on the job. Accidents involving tractor trailers, delivery vans, and cars driven by salesmen caused 18% of the nearly 6,100 fatal job injuries last year. Murders were a close second, most of them involving clerks behind the counters of convenience stores and other retail businesses who became victims during robberies. Women account for only 7% of the fatalities, but 40% of their workplace deaths are from murders. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new TV season is in full swing. Over the next half hour, we'll feature interviews from our archives with some of the people involved with two of the season's new shows. The new series, Frasier, is a spinoff from Cheers. Now Frasier hosts a radio call-in psychology show. But he's having psychological adjustment problems of his own because his father's just moved in with him. The father is played by John Mahoney. Mahoney got his start in theater. He was invited to join the Steppenwolf Theater Company in Chicago by the company's co-founder, John Malkovich. He's since appeared in such films as Eight Men Out, Say Anything, Moonstruck, In the Line of Fire, and Striking Distance. I spoke with him in May of 1990, before his performance of David Mamet's adaptation of Chekhov's Uncle Vanya. Acting as Mahoney's second career, he used to edit a medical journal. I asked him what he covered.
Ophthalmology or cataract surgery or central supply, or it could be anything, virtually any aspect of the healthcare system as it is within a hospital. And it's very, very boring, actually. I've tried to think of some way to make it more interesting, but it isn't, and it wasn't, which is a lot to do with why I don't do it anymore.
When did you know that you were really unhappy in this job?
Well, it wasn't anything that where you go home every night and bang your head against a wall and say, "Oh my God, I'm so unhappy." It was just an insidious thing. You just keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and gradually you realize that you're smoking an awful lot, and that you're drinking a little bit too much, and that you're sleeping very late whenever you can. And it wasn't until I started to do my new job, which was acting, that I looked back and realized the absolute depth of my depression while I was doing the editorial work.
All the years that you weren't acting and you were editing this medical newsletter, did you use any acting skills in your life?
No, I didn't. I think I was storing up a lot of things that I have used since.
You weren't sitting at your desk impersonating people or, you know, just using in everyday life skills associated with acting.
No, I really wasn't, unless lying is part of that, you know. I mean, obviously, I'd have to lie to writers who couldn't write their way out of a paper bag and tell them how wonderful they were as I tried to make their stuff publishable. So maybe if good acting is good lying, then maybe I was doing that.
You grew up in England. What happened to your English accent?
Well, I tried very hard to lose it. I immigrated to the States when I was 19, and I'm from the north of England. I'm not the sort of person who likes to stand out in a crowd, which might sound strange for an actor. I mean, I like to shine on the stage or in a film, but on one-on-one, I just like to be like everybody else. And even in those days, it used to drive me crazy when people would say, "Oh, I love the way you talk. Oh, isn't that wonderful?" Or say this, or say that, or say banana, or say, you know. And they were being nice, but it would drive me crazy. And so I set out to learn how to speak like an American. And I would ask people, I was in the Army at the time, and I'd ask people, how do you pronounce this? How do you say half? And they'd say half. And I'd say, how do you say banana? How banana? And I'd write them down, and I'd drill myself just like I was learning a foreign language. The only trouble was I was in the Army with people from all over the United States. So somebody from Nebraska would tell me how to say one thing, and somebody from Brooklyn would tell me how to say something else. So I had this horrible mongrel accent when I got out. But when I went to school in Quincy, Illinois, I went to Quincy College, and by the time I got out of Quincy, of course, it had pretty much settled into this Midwestern thing that I have now. But I tried very hard to lose it, and it was to fit in. As boring as that sounds, it was to be like everybody else. That's why I did it.
You know how you worked on your voice to get rid of your English accent?
Uh-huh.
When you started acting, did you do any work with your voice on enunciation? You have a beautiful voice and great enunciation.
You.
Yeah. I mean, not over-enunciation, but
yeah.
It's just really great. Did you work that up? Was it natural already?
That was pretty natural, yes. I'll tell you, I worked on the timbre of my voice when I was doing Orphans before we moved to New York.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to be playing an alcoholic, and I wanted a rough quality in my voice that I didn't have. And so I worked very, very hard to get a gravelly quality to it. And my voice never quite recovered from that. And so it sounds a little different now than it did when I first started out. But it's to my advantage, actually, because I guess I have a much more distinctive voice now than I used to have. And people notice it and remember me by it, which I like very much. As far as enunciation, no. That just comes, I think, from possibly being born and raised in England, perhaps, or I just do tend to enunciate. I remember John Malkovich telling me, you know, you're the only person I know who speaks in sentences. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, when you say lines, you can see where the period comes. You can see where the capital letter starts. You can see where the paragraph ends. And I noticed when I watched other people in Steppenwolf work, that it's true. They try very consciously to break things up to make it more conversational. But you see, conversational to me is sentences. I think I express myself well, and I don't know whether it's my education or my background or because my family did. I never did speak that broken way. So
it must be
hard
for you to do
Mammoth,
then, huh?
Should I try? Well, no, actually, David at least writes in sentences.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think of what would be more difficult. When we did In a Nightingale Sang, it was a little difficult because, or to do something like Virginia Woolf would be a little difficult because mm-hmm. it's written with so many ellipses. But Mammoth, no. Even though there are a lot of short one-word sentences even, it's at least you know what he wants. Even like in this particular adaptation of Uncle Vanya, at one point I say, eat, sleep. Drink. I'm talking about the way my life is now as opposed to working. All I seem to do now is eat, sleep, drink. They're all one-word sentences, according to David, I guess to stop you from doing that horrible thing that so many people do now. All I do is eat and sleep and drink, you know, that horrible way that people have learned how to talk from television. And I guess as a way to get around that, David very specifically made them sentences, and so it stops you from doing that, and it's great. I love it, because I wouldn't do it anyway, and it's nice to know that I'm doing what David wants as well.
When you were working up the gravelly voice, what did you do?
I used to lock myself in closets, and I used to do very, very strenuous vocal warm-up exercises, and I used to, people didn't want to be in the same room as me. I made these horrible sounds. I mean, I started slowly, and I warmed my voice up before I started doing that. And as far as I know, knock on wood, I haven't hurt it or damaged it. But people do say, especially as at the end of an evening when my voice is pretty much shot, or not at the end of an evening, but at the end of a two-show day, people get worried about it and say, are you all right? Is your voice okay? And I say, oh, yeah, it's fine, no problem. It'll be back tomorrow just the same, and it always is. It's always there just as strong as can be. But people who it did, the things that I did sound terrible. I know it shocked a lot of actors with the ferocity of my vocal warm-ups. Shocked a lot of people in New York.
What were you doing?
Well, I can't do it on the radio because, for one thing, it's much too loud. And for another thing, it's just much too ugly. You know, if I back way away from the microphone, I might be able to give you a little demonstration here. It's just something like...
Wow.
Now, I don't know what you heard there, because I backed away quite a bit.
That's really something, so you'd lock yourself up in a closet and do that for a long time.
Well, it's not, I mean, and I wouldn't do it just right off the bat, just like I did then.
Uh-huh.
I'd do very gentle things first, you know, just sort
yeah.
of, things like that until, for a good half hour, I spend a lot of time warming my voice up so that I don't damage it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm very happy with the way it turned out, actually. I think it's gotten me a lot of work, to tell you the truth.
John Mahoney plays Frasier's father in the new series Frasier. Dennis Franz and Stephen Bochco from our archives. After this break, this is Fresh Air. The new series, NYPD Blue, has brought together two fine actors and paired them as partners. David Caruso plays a cop who's willing to bend the law to get justice. Dennis Franz plays his partner, an older, even more cynical, burned-out cop. In this scene from the first episode, Caruso tries to straighten out Franz.
This has got to stop, Andy.
What's got to stop?
This. You're getting stiff every afternoon now.
Hey, look. I don't recall requesting any career counseling session from you.
When was the last time you tried going on a wagon?
When's the last time you tried growing tits?
All right, maybe we better talk in the morning.
No. Let's talk now.
Okay. I think we should call it quits.
Meaning what?
Meaning us being partners.
Yeah, sure. Get a little bored at home, you dump your wife. Got a few problems at work, you dump your partner.
First of all, I didn't dump her, she dumped me. And second of all, I've been carrying you. I know it, you know it. Every cop in the station house knows it. And I'm sick of it.
All right, you want to split up? That's no problem. It's no problem at all.
NYPD Blue is reminiscent of Hill Street Blues for a couple of obvious reasons. Both shows were co-created by Stephen Bochco. They both co-starred Dennis Franz. We've gone into the archives for interviews with each of them. Bochco also co-created L.A. Law and Doogie Howser. NBC approached him in the 70s to create a cop drama. I asked him how he wanted Hill Street to be different from other cop shows.
We started out with this sort of checklist of things we didn't want to be. And a lot of what we wound up with on Hill Street kind of, it was a little bit like form following function. We had a large group of characters that we had developed, and what we discovered pretty quickly as we wrote the pilot is that there's no way on a weekly basis that we were going to be able to dramatically honor the needs of what had quickly become a dozen regular characters, 10 or 11, whatever the exact number was. And so we developed a story flow that would span 2, 3, 4 episodes at a time, because it was the only way that you could involve your characters in complex stories without devoting a lot of screen time per episode to those characters. And so in that way, we began to develop what really didn't seem all that new to us. It was sort of a police soap opera, and we sort of kiddingly always referred to it as cop soap.
You have the reputation for being the kind of producer who'll put his job on the line if there's something you really want to fight about with the network or standards and practices. What's an example of something you put your job on the line for in Hill Street?
Oh, gosh, there were so many of them. Gosh, I remember one time we had an episode where some elderly woman was having an affair, and her husband came home and caught them, and he chased the guy through the house, and the guy was trying to get out the bathroom window, and he got his head lodged in between the side of the toilet and the bathtub where he was stuck. So they call the police, and Hill and Renko arrive on the scene, and they're puzzling as to how to free this guy. And of course, they finally free him with they shatter the toilet with a sledgehammer. But in the course of it, the husband, who by now has sort of reconciled with his wife, turns to his wife, and it really was a background piece of dialogue, and said, "What really upsets me is that you took your teeth out for him." And they went nuts. They simply went berserk over that piece of dialogue, which was a background piece of dialogue. They never objected to it on the page. So what happened was that we shot the scene. We didn't have close-ups coverage of the various elements in the scene. So there it was. It was not excisable from the scene, and they said you had to take it out. So I guess that's about as angry as I ever got, because, you know, the deal that I always had with them was if you give me time, I think I can pretty much accommodate any of the notes you have that I can't sway you on. But when you give me a note like that after we've shot the film, I'm trapped. And then, of course, to fix it, you have to butcher the film. You know, one of the interesting things we discovered over the years is that you'd have all these terrible fights in a vacuum. Then finally, and you'd scream and you'd yell and you'd rattle your saber and you'd threaten to quit and they'd back down and you shoot the film and it goes on the air. Nobody says boo. Mm-hmm. Nobody writes you a letter. And what you begin to realize, A, is that you've got a far more sophisticated audience watching what you do than networks are willing to admit. And B, the Republic doesn't fall. That audience comes to you Thursdays at 10 o'clock looking for a degree of sophistication and complexity and humor. And they're very happy with the product they get, by and large.
Stephen Bochco co-created Hill Street Blues and the new series NYPD Blue. Watching Dennis Franz on NYPD Blue is like seeing an old friend, because his role is so similar to his character of Bunce on Hill Street. Bunce was a tough-talking, gum-chewing cop who was always ready to bend the rules to get the job done, which constantly got him into trouble with the captain. Physically, Bunce was hard to miss, a stocky, balding man dressed in wide ties and polyester suits. In this scene from Hill Street, Bunce tried to cut a deal with D.A. Joyce Davenport.
Miss Davenport.
I'm short on time, Lieutenant.
This won't take long.
If you're leading up to some kind of deal, I've already told the D.A. my client's not interested.
Your client's a flea, Miss Davenport. He's a microscopic particle. It's the people who hired him we want.
I've told you, Lieutenant, we're not looking for any deals. I'm doing court.
This is a deal with a difference, please. Seeing Higby's definitely going to do some time, probably a lot. The only question is what kind of time he's going to do, considering his condition.
What condition?
You're familiar with the exact nature of Higby's wound.
Lieutenant.
The way it lightened him up, I mean. So now he's a little short in the crucial equipment department.
I'm listening.
If Higby's fellow inmates were to somehow find out how he ain't the man he used to be, how he ain't even a man at all, so to speak.
You're saying he'd be abused?
As in badly.
And unless Higby names his alleged employers, you'd see to it that somebody got the word out. That offer is astoundingly improper, Lieutenant. You try it, and I'll hit you with a restraining order.
Just tell him what I told you, all right?
I'll, of course, relay to Mr. Higby anything that's relevant to his case.
That's all we can ask, Counselor.
In 1987, I asked Dennis Franz about the tacky polyester suits he wore on Hill Street.
The first time I came in for a costume fitting and I saw all these polyesters and these clashing colors, I thought, oh boy, this something's off here, because first they've thrown his name at me, Norman Bunce, which I wasn't too thrilled about to begin with, and then they've given me this weird clothes, and I thought, our concepts are getting real strange here. So I kind of realized that what they wanted was we were after a list of contradictions in character, and I've described Norman Bunce as sort of a human mutt, and that he does have a lot of different characteristics, and they don't all fit into the same person. But somehow it's interesting to watch that, and my reasoning in why he chooses his clothes, I think he really feels that he's dressing pretty sharp. He just has
bad taste
in clothes. As long as everything he's wearing has brown in it, regardless of the pattern or which direction those patterns are going in, that's fine. He looks pretty swell, you know, as far as he's concerned, because they're all brown and blue or green or whatever the color may be.
Were you able to base that character on anyone you knew? And I guess I'm wondering, too, if you grew up in a tough neighborhood in Chicago or a working-class neighborhood in Chicago where you were apt to meet people like him.
I grew up in a suburb out of Chicago. It was about 7 miles out of the city proper in Maywood. The area was, yes, very much of a working-class neighborhood. My father was a postal worker, and he worked in a factory, and my mother also worked at the post office. There was a heavy, tough element in our neighborhood. We had gangs. I wasn't a part of them, but a lot of my friends were members of gangs, and therefore I had an association with them. I kind of walked a fine line always because I kept those friends, and then when I got involved in theater, of course the gangs didn't want to have nothing to do with the theater, so I had both sides of the fence, and I was able to play both sides too, so I had different groups of friends that were complete opposites. I guess it was a matter of me always observing, getting to your initial question about did I draw on any of anybody in particular to form the character. It's been sort of an observational existence that I've always had, watching the other sides and being in touch with both of them, but knowing how they work. But I don't specifically have one person that I can identify with in forming the character of Norman Bunce.
Something very unprecedented happened on your career with Hill Street Blues. You first had a role as a bad cop called Sal Benedetto back in the 82-83 series. You were on a few episodes of that. The character commits suicide, and then they brought you back a few years later in the role of Norman Bunce.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to leave? Did you ask to be let out of the series, or did they kill you off even though
you
wanted to stay?
I did everything possible to stay on that show. In fact, really, the course of events was that they were in the process of creating a new show called Beverly Hills, that's now called Bay City Blues, and that was about a minor league baseball team. Stephen Bochco, Jeffrey Lewis, and some of the other people at Hill Street were putting this new show together. They asked me if I would be interested in being a regular on that show. I absolutely said yes. They went ahead and they made Benedetto as bad as they could, so it necessitated him having to take his life and be eliminated from the show. Once Bay City was not successful, we made 8 episodes and it was canceled. I made every possible overture to get back on Hill Street. I realized I'm very fortunate that I have been able to be a part of my favorite show on television, and I missed that opportunity. I missed being a part of it, and I without question wanted to be with them again. And I said, whatever hair I got left, you can dye blonde. I'll get rid of my mustache. I'll come back as Benedetto's gay brother seeking revenge. I'll do anything to get back on the show. That's how much I love everybody over there. So we weren't able to work that out. It took a couple of years for my character to be able to return in the form of Norman Bunce.
Dennis Franz, recorded in 1987. You can see him now on NYPD Blue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the man behind the show that's often funnier than Letterman, Leno, or Arsenio. The Larry Sanders Show is a satire of late-night talk shows. This season's finale is playing now on HBO. We'll hear an interview with the star Gary Shandling from our archives. Robert De Niro not only stars in the new movie A Bronx Tale, he also directs, for the first time. Film critic Stephen Schiff will have a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The Indian government has relaxed its attitude toward accepting international financial assistance in the aftermath of a deadly earthquake. Andrew Whitehead reports from New Delhi.
India usually likes to manage disaster relief operations itself, sometimes politely declining offers of assistance from overseas. It's not simply a matter of national pride. The army and civil authorities are used to coping with emergencies and know best how to operate in difficult terrain with poor communications. But given the immense destruction wrought by the earthquake and the many offers of assistance from around the world, the government in Delhi has made clear that it will, in principle, accept outside help. Money will be channeled into the relief fund set up by the Prime Minister, P.V. Narasimha Rao. That's where £25,000 donated by the British government has gone. A senior official at the Agriculture Ministry in Delhi will assess offers of emergency supplies. The authorities are known to be eager for specialist equipment, tents, plastic roofing, and medicines.
Andrew Whitehead for the BBC. Israel and Jordan say they've agreed to establish a joint economic committee. The two countries are still considered at war, but they are negotiating as part of the ongoing Mideast peace talks. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and Jordanian Crown Prince Hassan appeared jointly with President Clinton at the White House for the announcement. The committee will work on economic and environmental issues. President Clinton intends to try to smooth out differences with China. He will meet with China's president during an Asian conference in Seattle next month, and Mr. Clinton will probably send the Treasury and Agriculture secretaries on trips to Beijing. Barry Schwide has more.
There's a lot to talk about, most of it unpleasant. The Chinese are snubbing President Clinton's call for a worldwide moratorium and then a treaty to ban nuclear weapons tests. And in August, Mr. Clinton imposed sanctions on Chinese firms accused of providing Pakistan with missile technology. Also, China's human rights record will get an airing. More than most nations, China seems impervious to international pressures, but it does want to keep its trading privileges with the United States, which the president has extended for a year. This could give Mr. Clinton leverage in his talks with the Chinese leader. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Negotiations between Russian President Boris Yeltsin and the parliament he dissolved were unsuccessful today. Lawmakers who refused to leave the parliament building have rejected a tentative agreement that had been worked out with officials of the Russian Orthodox Church as mediators. Talks are to resume tomorrow. Yeltsin has promised not to use violence to remove the legislators from their building, but he did assault them with rock music today. Songs blared over loudspeakers in a strategy borrowed from the U.S. military in Panama. This is NPR News in Washington. The government's tool for forecasting economic growth predicts a good but not booming finish for 1993. The Commerce Department says the index of leading indicators rose a full point in August. It was the third consecutive report showing that rate of improvement. The report says 10 out of 11 indicators rose. the first time that many were up since December 1986. The government also says factory orders increased 0.9 of a point in August, mainly because of bigger orders for aircraft and cars. But the backlog of unfilled orders dropped to its lowest level in more than 5 years. That's bad news for employment because companies won't feel pressure to hire to fill orders. Gasoline cost 4.3 cents more per gallon today. The gas tax hike is aimed at lowering the federal budget deficit. In Ohio, some truckers have been tying up traffic to protest the higher tax. Kevin Niedermeyer of member station WKSU reports.
Across Ohio, several hundred truck drivers have been slowing their rigs down on the interstates and the turnpike, causing traffic jams to show their displeasure with the new federal fuel tax. A service plaza on the Ohio Turnpike near Cleveland became a staging area for about 50 truckers preparing to start one of those slowdowns. One driver says they're just trying to make a point about the added expense.
It'd have put a crimp in our, more or less our budget in that, but the profits remain the same. They're not increasing. So, you know, we're not making any headway. We're losing ground instead of gaining.
The Ohio Highway Patrol says they've arrested two truckers and issued nearly 100 citations for the slowdowns. They add that it's a very small minority that's responsible for the protests. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer in Cleveland.
On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 26 points. Advancing issues led declines by an 11-9 margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The Larry Sanders Show is a parody of late-night talk shows. It's often funnier than the real thing. Gary Shandling is the show's star and co-writer. Shandling parodies talk show hosts so well because he used to be the real thing. He used to be Johnny Carson's regular substitute host. But Shandling gave up The Tonight Show to concentrate on his first comedy series, It's Gary Shandling Show, which premiered in 1986. The Larry Sanders Show's second season finale is now running on HBO. One day last December, Gary Shandling was supposed to join us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. But shortly before the interview was to begin, Shandling's publicist called to say Gary had car troubles and couldn't get to the studio. So we did the interview from his home phone. Okay, so you can imagine what went through my mind when I found out that your car wouldn't start. In your talk show experiences, have you ever had that happen where someone doesn't show up and they say their car isn't working?
No, it is the flimsiest excuse, isn't it? It would be better to say my dog ate the car, I mean, or something. It sounds like one of those horrible high school excuses.
So what kind of car do you drive that's giving you this trouble?
The worst story than that, what it is exactly, is my girlfriend bought a Range Rover, and I said to her, well, you know, a Range Rover in California, you know, it's a four-wheel drive vehicle, you know, and, you know, I guess she figures, you know, in case it starts raining, she can't get to that audition in time or something, you know. So it's a four-wheel drive. For me, it's a slightly affected car, although they're very nice cars, and it's hilarious because she bought it yesterday and it's brand new, and then she was going to drop me off at the studio and the car wouldn't start. So not only have I missed this opportunity to go directly to the studio, but simultaneously she's been on the phone screaming at the car dealer saying, Gary Shandling missed an interview, which of course meant far less to them than she'd hoped.
So listen, this talk show, you've done the talk show for real, you know, guest hosting on The Tonight Show, and now you're doing a parody of it. What's the difference, do you think, between Larry Sanders as a late-night host and Gary Shandling?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I actually think that on the talk show part itself, on the Larry Sanders Show talk show part that we see live on the air, that is basically me hosting a talk show. That is how I would host a talk show. Larry is very different than Gary as a person, and what we see backstage is not exactly me. Larry is much more driven career-wise, much more competitive career-wise, much more concerned about ratings than I am, much angrier than I am. On the air, he is very similar to what I would be like hosting a show. I find myself, since it's a satire of talk shows, doing a few Johnny moves that I wouldn't probably do if it was really me, and doing a few kind of Letterman moves that I wouldn't do.
On some of the episodes, there's a lot of tension between what's happening off camera and what's happening on camera. There's one in which you're fighting with your wife, kind of backstage, and then you have to keep running back on the air and being really affable. Has anything like that ever happened to you in yours in the time that you really hosted?
That particular thing has never happened. I have been in a relationship where right before I went on stage, and this is what I took the moment from, it was many years ago, and I was getting ready to go on stage at the Comedy Store, and my girlfriend at the time said, I really want to discuss our relationship. And I said, I'm on in 2 minutes. Well, she said, there's never a good time to talk to you, is there? And we were really having an argument right before I went on stage. And then that kind of thing never stopped. I was hit by a car about 6 months after that, and I was in the hospital with all these tubes connected to me. And she came to the hospital, and I was on the critical list, and she said, I really want to talk to you about our relationship. And I was like on Demerol at the time. And I said, if I don't think this is the right time, but anyway, it sounds like I probably was very shut down and not communicative, but I was, and she just picked the wrong time. So we took that element and made a show out of it.
Boy, I hope she wasn't thinking that you would do anything to get out of talking about the relationship. You'd do stand up, you'd get into a car accident, anything to avoid that discussion.
I never thought of it that way. But I guess when I joined the astronaut program,
My guest is Gary Shandling. He's the star and co-writer of The Larry Sanders Show. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gary Shandling. Now, I think that the auto accident that you referred to earlier also had something to do with you deciding to change directions.
There was a chain of events that happened. I was, it was right around the time of I'd finished my Welcome Back, Kotter, and I was doing a script for Three's Company, and I also had a pilot I was writing, and I was unhappy creatively, and then I got hit by a car, which we don't need the details of, but I was hit by a car and really seriously hurt. And as I was laying in the hospital, I really did realize, I had one of those realizations, like, what do you really want to do in your life is what you should look at, and then try for that. And the only thing that I knew that I wanted to do was develop comedically. I've never had a goal other than when I was hosting The Tonight Show, which really was a goal of mine. But I never had a career goal. It was more an inside creative goal to learn to use my funniness and to discover what my level of ability was. And that's what I went after when I went on stage. It was really a self-discovery process.
So when you were lying there in the hospital, mm-hmm. fighting for your life, were you...
Funny? Was I funny?
Well, seriously, since you were thinking so much about comedy, were you already trying to transform this into, like, your next routine?
Yeah, I did. I wrote several routines in the hospital.
You really did?
I wrote my first time on The Tonight Show, my first stand-up piece was a piece about being in the hospital and hearing that woman in the hospital paging doctors all day long going, Dr. Juergens, Dr. Mark Juergens, over that hospital intercom.
Uh-huh.
Dr. McAvoy, Dr. John McAvoy. And I was in the hospital for 2 weeks, and I heard that hospital intercom 24 hours a day for 2 weeks, and I realized this woman could say anything, and no one would know the difference. She could go, Dr. Pudding, Dr. Chocolate Pudding, and someone would show up.
When you started doing stand-up, did you have a sense of who you wanted to be on stage? Like what aspects of your own personality you really wanted to bring out for your stage persona?
It was really a nightmare. I had no idea who I was when I started, and I was frightened to death and had no natural performing skills. I'd never performed before in my life, and to be thrown onto the stand-up stage is an experience that you cannot fathom until you're actually there, because there's no place to go, and everyone's looking at you, and you can't even see them because of the lights. And yet you have to manage to start talking and be funny on top of it. And at the beginning, I think I did. I wrote material that was very much influenced by Woody Allen, who's my favorite. And I used to do very offbeat jokes that sounded like I was reading them. And it took years to develop a style. And actually, what happened is I was involved in a relationship, and the girl left me, and I was very hurt, and I had to go up on stage, and I finally just turned to the audience and said, this girl left me. I said, what happened is she moved in with another guy. So I dumped her, because that's where I draw the line. And so that was the beginning. That was really the beginning of, you know, people of the Gary Shandling dating years in stand-up that came out, you know, because I realized, oh, I started to really spill my guts about being hurt, and people really related to it. And it just was one of those things. It was in a nightclub in Dallas. I really remember it very well.
Can you give me a sense of what you were doing before you started doing the more personal stuff?
They were awful jokes like... you know, I had a high school principal who, actually this is true, I had a high school principal who committed suicide by hanging himself in the rings in the gymnasium. And it was the next day that my physical education coach found him hanging there in the rings, and he gave him a 9.8.
Oh, God.
And it was stuff like that. That really was not connected to, you know. Actually, that really all happened, of course, other than the 9.8, but every part of that story is true. I said I had a real stupid, I said my coach was really stupid. He had a big sundial in his front yard, and he pulled his back out trying to wind it. It was that kind of stuff that barely worked.
It seems to me one of the problems of becoming a celebrity is that celebrities start to take themselves really seriously and think of themselves as being just, like, terribly important.
Yeah.
And that to maintain the kind of humor that you're doing now on your shows, like, you know, the It's Gary Shandling show and the Larry Sanders show, you have to be a little bit detached from all of that in order to kind of see the humor of people taking themselves too seriously and to stand outside a little bit, both from celebrity land and from TV and movie land, and look into it. Do you worry about that being a bit of a problem, of ever getting too far inside?
You know, I think that's really a great perception. I think you're 100% accurate, and that's smart. And you recognize something that a lot of performers don't recognize, and they do start to take themselves too seriously. The truth is that I don't, and in fact, often need to work on giving myself a little more self-importance, you know, because I still think of myself as the guy from Tucson. And what that allows me to do is look around at my friends, and I just cannot name them here, but I know the ones that I, and their friends and acquaintances, that often turn my stomach because they think they're great, and they think that they're important, and they have this aura of self-importance that has nothing to do with being a human being, and they become affected, and I'm able to see that clearly, and that's why I wanted to do this show is to you know, expose that and show how fake it is in terms of our real, you know, real life existence. I wish I could name names, but I just have friends who do movies and big movies, and my God, they have attitudes.
Yeah, one can only conclude
that... It irritates me. If I sound irritated about it, it's something that really pushes one of my buttons. It's something that I really dislike.
Okay, so on the one hand, you could kind of, there's the risk of getting too big and really getting carried away by that. On the other hand, do you also live in fear of, like, being washed up and doing infomercials for hair replacement or something?
Well, what's wrong with that? I'm doing one next week. What's the problem with that? Hi, this is Gary Shandling. Have you seen this new product? You spray it on your forehead, it makes it look like your hair comes down to your eyebrows. I'm telling you, I never looked younger. The Popeil Pocket Hair Sprayer. I think I just saw that. There's a product where you just spray the back of your head with basically, you know, a work crew comes in and spray paints the back of your head with black paint. And they say it's going to look like hair. Anyway.
So do you worry about this?
No, I mean, I worry about, you know, that I'm not growing or that I've reached my potential sometimes and sort of have to push myself to see if there's more there, you know, but I'm also, I also look sometimes for, I wish I could sort of get out of show business. I just don't know what I would do on a weekly basis. I fantasize about moving to Hawaii, you know.
Thanks a lot for your time. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Gary Shandling recorded last year. The season finale of The Larry Sanders Show is now running on HBO. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have from India on the earthquake, on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We've reached Edward Gargan of the New York Times. He's been into the area that's been hardest hit. He describes the collapsed homes and the funeral pyres burning there. I'll talk with a seismologist who explains why this type of earthquake is so hard to predict. A report from New York on hearings, charges of corruption within the New York City Police Department, including involvement in drug trafficking. Also, Peter Richman on the notion that there could be a new Yankee Stadium in Midtown Manhattan, moving out of the Bronx, and a tribute to the motion picture, Night of the Living Dead.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Actor Robert De Niro is now director Robert De Niro, too. He's given himself an acting role in his directorial debut movie, A Bronx Tale. But the real star is the actor Chaz Palminteri, who originally wrote A Bronx Tale as a theater monologue for himself and then adapted it into a screenplay. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Robert De Niro doesn't look exactly out of place in this setting. We're in an Italian-American neighborhood in New York City during the 60s, with doo-wop music sung in the alleys and Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin on the jukebox, and guys with names like Tony Toupee and Frankie Coffeecake hanging around on the mean streets. If the territory looks familiar, it's because we've been to Martin Scorsese country so many times before. In fact, we've seen almost these very scenes. The story of the young Italian boy torn between the sturdy immigrant values his parents are trying to instill and the allure of the gangsters he sees hanging out in restaurants and social clubs. This time the boy is Calogero, who's played at the age of 9 by a terrific young actor named Francis Capra and then at 17 by a not-so-terrific actor named Lilo Brancato. All his young life, Calodro has wanted to be exactly like the neighborhood's big kahuna, a slick gangster named Sonny, played by the screenwriter Chaz Palminteri. Palminteri has a great gangsterish look, well-tailored suits, slicked back hair, dark, smoky eyes, and a thick, thuggish mouth that looks like Edward G. Robinson's. When Sonny starts taking an interest in Calodro, the kid's father, a bus driver named Lorenzo, is naturally alarmed. Lorenzo's played by De Niro himself. And in this scene, he confronts Sonny about the money the gangster has been giving the boy. Clearly, Sonny isn't used to Lorenzo's tone.
First of all, I respect you, Lorenzo. You're a stand-up guy. We're from the same neighborhood.
But don't ever talk to me like that again.
I tell your son to go to school, to go to college.
You don't understand. It's not what you say. It's what he sees. It's the clothes, it's the cars, it's the money, it's everything. He tried to throw away his baseball cards the other day because he said Mickey Mantle will never pay my rent.
He said that to you?
That's not funny. Not funny when your 9-year-old kid has a bigger bank account than you do.
I offered you a job, but you said no to me.
That's right, and I say no now. Just leave my son alone, please. Don't you see how I treat that kid? I treat that kid like he's my son.
He ain't your son. He's my son.
He's what?
He's my son.
Come on, get the f*** out of here.
I'm not afraid of you.
Well, you shouldn't.
I know who you are, Sonny. I know what you're capable of, and I would never step out of line. You could ask anybody in this neighborhood who knows me. But this time you're wrong. You don't fool with a man's family. This is my son, not yours.
What are you going to do, fight
you
me?
You stay away from my
get
son.
Out. Even in that short scene, you can tell that this is De Niro in his solid citizen, ordinary Joe mode, which is to say De Niro at his dullest. Still, maybe that's as it should be, since this is a movie about a kid having to choose between two fathers and two sets of values. And it sharpens the contrast if Lorenzo seems humdrum and Sonny thrilling. The trouble is that Palminteri, the screenwriter, has sentimentalized Sonny. Not only is this shark smooth and attractive, he's also loving and paternal and wise, an endless fount of fatherly advice. In fact, as Sonny's advice gushes on the one hand and Lorenzo's on the other, the audience gets to feeling soaked. This is, in short, a surprisingly wet gangster picture. After a captivating, if familiar, first half, little Calodro grows into big Calodro, and Palminteri's nostalgia takes over. The movie becomes listless. And De Niro's sometimes muddy storytelling begins to get on your nerves. A Bronx Tale has its moments, but I'm afraid we've toured this neighborhood too many times before, and with better guides.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblaitis, and Chris Fraley. Our program was directed by Naomi Person. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Terry Anderson survived his 7 years in captivity with remarkable lucidity, compassion, and forgiveness. On the next Fresh Air, we'll meet Anderson and his wife, Madeline Basile. They've just co-authored a memoir about the years Anderson was held hostage. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.